live from the Blessed John Paul II Radio Studio at the Archdiocese of Boston Pastoral Center, this is The Good Catholic Life, a show that discusses local Catholic initiatives and events, explains Catholic teaching, and profiles Catholic leaders and ministries. Our hosts are Scott Landry and Michael Levine. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, 2013. Our guest today is Chris Faddis, author of It Is Well, Life in the Storm. This is The Good Catholic Life.
Thank you, Dom. Happy Wednesday, everyone, and I'm certainly in a good mood this week, Michael, after two wonderful Red Sox victories, and, you know, we shouldn't use the word in secular terms on our show, but what the heck. That miraculous comeback by the Patriots on Sunday. As a huge sports fan, it's been a great week, and we hope that this month of October and the good luck continues for the Sox and Patriots. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks, Scott. Yes, it's been a nice beginning to the week from a sports perspective, and I have to say I missed the comeback, both comebacks on Sunday, because I was traveling back home from a wedding that I attended in Ohio, but I've caught up.
It's amazing, and it makes you want to stay up a little bit later. You know, I haven't made it to the end of all those Red Sox games. Yesterday was beautiful because it was a 4:07 start. Should we be that lucky throughout the rest of the playoffs? Most likely not. But people are in a better mood in towns of Belmont, throughout Boston, down in Braintree where you are, and across the region. So we hope that that continues. My kids, when we get to be this close, are always saying, Dad, when's the parade? When's the parade? So hopefully we're able to go to a Sox parade in just a few weeks. But, Michael, we have a phenomenal show today. It moved me in preparation for it, and I think it's going to move our listeners. As we're going to talk with Chris Faddis, who's just written a book, It Is Well, Life in the Storm. And the book is specifically focused on how do you trust God more? How do you put your reliance on God when you're going through one of the most difficult situations that you could ever go through? In Chris's case, the cancer and then the eventual death of his wife with two very young kids.
Yeah, I learned about this story over Facebook about a year and 3 months ago, and right from the very beginning, it struck a chord with me as a husband, as a father of then five. I really was moved by the dedication of both Angela and Chris to Jesus Christ and their willingness to be a witness in the middle of the most difficult of tragedies, to a witness to Jesus Christ and sharing their story to everyone else.
So it was on September the 21st of 2002, just about 8 o'clock in the morning, when Angela Faddis went home to God. She was diagnosed with cancer on Easter Sunday, about 18 months prior to that, on April the 24th of 2011. And our guest, Chris Faddis, the author of this book detailing that struggle, the title is It Is Well, Life in the Storm, is joining us on The Good Catholic Life for the first time. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott and Michael, and thank you for allowing me to share our story.
So let's go back to early 2001. You and Angela had been married since July 1st of 2006, just about almost five years then. And then on Easter Sunday, what happened?
Angela had been sick for about 8 days. She'd had abdominal cramping and constipation and things, and we had been to the doctor and nothing was working. So middle of the night, Holy Saturday into Easter Sunday, we finally decided to take her into the ER and really thought they would do something routine, an enema or something, and she'd be out. And, she kept saying, I just need an enema and I can have ham for dinner, and she would kind of joke about it. And next thing you know, the doctors are calling me back to the hospital. I had taken the kids home at her request, and they're calling me back to the hospital because they want to see me. Didn't really quite grasp the severity of it when I was getting the kids back in the car, and as I started to drive and get back on the highway, I realized that the doctors wouldn't want to see me if it was just a routine deal. So Came to the hospital. A nurse immediately came out and got my children. I walked back, and doctors were in and said, you know, the words that I think many of us have maybe rehearsed or thought of or heard or seen movies of, and they said, you know, you have a massive tumor in your colon, and she had tumors all over her liver. And essentially, without biopsy, they can't diagnose, but essentially we were facing in that moment advanced stage 4 colon cancer, very advanced. So it was everything, every bit of pain, shock, the, you know, you see the movies where the person hears the, you know, the sound in the background, no sound, and it's just this kind of echo or maybe this tunnel sound. That's what it felt like. And there was nothing I really could say in that moment to comfort her. I didn't know what to say. And the amazing thing was that my wife, who had suffered with depression previously, who had been through a lot of hard times in her own walk, normally looked to me for the comforting words. And instead, in this moment, she looked up at me and said, Jesus still rose, so we will trust. And it was everything I needed to hear to remind me this was the promise we had in Christ, that he still rose.
So she said, Jesus still rose, so we will trust. Chris, you had been married to Angela for 5+ years. You had known her a little bit prior to that. Did that surprise you in that moment that she came up with something so hopeful and so trusting in God in perhaps, up until that point, one of the toughest hours of her life, hearing that she had this really severe bout with cancer?
You know, it didn't surprise me completely. What surprised me is that she came up with that so fast. That it was, you know, that would, I would expect her to come up with that later in the day as she faced the grief and as she kind of came out of that, because normally she would just feel that attack and it would take her some time. And she always, in our journey together, would turn her heart, you know, hardships and lament and all of that back to God. But it always took time. And in this moment, I think what was most surprising was that there wasn't a tear in her eye. There wasn't, you know, a whole lot of fear in her face. It was just faith. In that very moment, she literally, all she had in that moment was faith, and that's what expressed. So that was the most surprising to me, that it was such a quick response, but also not a trite response. It was a quick response and a very real, true, to the core of her being response.
One of the things that interested me a lot in reading the book, Chris, It Is Well, Life in the Storm, written by Chris Faddis, our guest today on The Good Catholic Life, is that you and Angela had been talking about collaborating on a book about trust. And one of the things that you both noted is it's sometimes easy to trust after the fact or see the trust, but there wasn't a book that either of you had read that was about trust in the middle of a storm. And you guys had been thinking about that and beginning to work on this project, and then you were faced with that very storm.
Yeah, it was one of those things where you look back and you think, you know, when you look back at life and you say, okay, how was God preparing me uniquely for this moment, for this piece? And it was probably about 9 months into our journey that I finally kind of started to see that and realize, wow, you know, I'm getting letters from people, because we were sharing our story online and people were following us and all of that. But never were we out there going, hey, this is perfect, let's go share this story because this is our trust story. It wasn't until about 9 months later that we realized what was happening and that God was allowing us to be the witness of trust in the storm. And that's when we sat down and started talking again about, I said to Angela, I think maybe this is our chance. This is, you know, we've said God's going to use this for his glory. Maybe this is how he wants to use it, is that we need to share this story.
And there were many moments as you were battling this cancer, the ups and the downs. Share with our listeners, Chris, the decision to move from North Carolina to Arizona and how you knew God was with you in this journey, walking with you, because of all the things that, as people of faith, we can say those just weren't random coincidences. That was God leading you and Angela back to Arizona.
Sure. You know, so we were in North Carolina for about 4 years, and I'm from Arizona, Angela, and I met in Arizona, and she felt like she would call Arizona home herself. So, we were in North Carolina. We weren't very happy living in North Carolina. We had great friends, and there were great things happening, but we weren't so happy there. But as just before Angela's cancer, we started to kind of get settled in and just feel like maybe this is God, where God has us for a while. And she got the diagnosis, and we had the discussion, you know, do we move back? And we said, you know what, we've got a world-class hospital here. We've got people here. I think we just have to stay. And after Angela's first two rounds of chemo essentially failed, you know, we had a vacation planned to go back home the next day after her chemo had failed, after we got the results that her chemo was not working. And while we were there, friends had set up appointments for us with specialized, you know, advanced cancer treatment centers and places in Phoenix. And they said, you know, we just think you should really consider this. And we had talked about it and just felt like it wasn't time. I had a great job. It was a unique job. It's not a job you can just go on the internet and find anywhere in the country. And I didn't know how I was going to do that. We visited with these doctors. We got, you know, got to see what these treatments looked like. We got to kind of investigate them. And we just felt by the middle of that vacation, which ended up being a little more of a vacation, but we felt very confident that we needed to try this. Whether or not we could move back permanently or Angela just had to live there, whatever it was. I also knew that Angela's heart was in Phoenix. She loved the desert. She loved everything about Arizona. And for her own vitality, her own well-being, that we needed to be there. So we just made the decision. We're going to figure this out. We're going to try to figure out how to pay for these treatments. Most of them weren't covered by insurance. And so we got home to North Carolina. She had surgery the next day, a procedure planned. And that day, while she was in surgery, I wrote up an online fundraising campaign. And as we were, backtrack just a little bit, as we were getting on the plane from Phoenix to North Carolina, you know, we're going, where are we going to live? We don't want to, you know, none of our family had a house big enough where we could have a lot of space. So if we lived with anyone, we'd have to have a little bedroom for the four of us. And we didn't know how any of that was going to happen. And we're getting on the plane, we're walking on the jetway, and I get a text message saying, you know, the Avanzini family is going to let you use their rental house for 4 months. You can have it for free. Just come out, and it's yours. And we just began to weep as we're walking on the plane. We get home. We do the online fundraising campaign. And I said to Angela, I said, you know, we had to raise about $60,000 in total. And I said, you know, I feel like I will feel comfortable driving back to Phoenix next week if we are able to raise, say, $10,000 by the end of this week. And she goes, that's crazy. I said, I know, but let's just ask God, and that would be, it would just make me feel better. Either way, we got to go back. That was Tuesday. I launched the campaign. I believe it was by Wednesday or Thursday. I think it was Wednesday night we had $10,000 raised, and by Friday, which was when I had said we could have this raised, we had $18,000 raised. And all of these pieces just lined up for us. So we drove out less than a week later. We got in the car. We drove to Phoenix. We moved in with friends for a couple weeks till the other house was ready. We got Angela's treatment started, and over the next month, all of that funds that we needed came in. Truly, only God could orchestrate that. Only God could orchestrate, even with my employer, to be able to say, hey, you know, we can split this part of what you do for us, and you can take that with you to Phoenix, and you can have that, and that way you don't have to be here. You know, all of these pieces just completely lined up, which was pretty incredible.
We're talking with Chris Faddis. He's the author of the book, It Is Well, Life in the Storm, and it recounts the difficult journey of accompanying his wife through her battle with cancer and then her death on September the 21st of 2012, just a little bit more than a year ago. Chris and Angela have two young children, Gianna and Gus. Is Gianna 6 now and Gus 4? Or
yes, that's correct, yeah.
So parenting through this situation, if it were just two adults, a couple who's very much in love with each other going through it, is a tremendously difficult situation to begin with. You had to be there for your children as well, Chris, as they were going through the grieving process of their mom suffering. How was that in the early stages of Angela's battle with cancer?
You know, the hardest part initially was the fact, you know, our children, you know, Angela stayed home with the kids. We had a very hands-on approach with our children, and just, we really, you know, I could count on one hand the amount of times they had been with a babysitter prior to her diagnosis. Then you fast forward, and within a day, suddenly they're having to stay at someone's house for a whole week because we're in the hospital, you know. And Gianna was at someone else's house on her birthday, celebrating her birthday with a different family, and a lovely family, an incredible family, but still. So a lot of it was, you know, initially was the grief for them was the separation they suddenly felt. Why are we suddenly being shifted all over the place, you know? So, you know, a big part of that was just really intently being with them when we could, you know, and when she wasn't in treatment or whatever, you know, even if Angela wasn't feeling well, you know, just she would just make sure she could sit up enough to read one book to them and just hold them, and they could play at the end of her bed or whatever happened, even if she was feeling nauseous, you know, she would do those things. And we just had to be very, very intent in that. And I think by the grace of God, I was in a position in my life where I had the time to do that, and I had the ability to adjust my work schedule to make it work to do that. I worked a lot of late nights, you know, to get through things that I couldn't do while, you know, during the day. So that was the initial piece. They knew their mom was sick. They knew that whatever she was sick with would take a long time. You know, we got them some books on cancer and on chemotherapy. There's different books out there for children, and so that helped. But ultimately, their biggest grief was this, wait a minute, you know, things are very different very quickly. How do we adjust to that? So, you know, I think especially as a man, you know, a lot of men get to kind of write some of that stuff off. You know, the middle of the night when your child goes through a phase where they're, you know, need to be walked to sleep and they wake up several times throughout the night and they need to be walked to go back to sleep. Most of us men get to just kind of shut that off because our wife takes care of that for us. And that's a great gift. But I think what you learn in this kind of a situation is, you know, you didn't necessarily plan for this, but you signed up for all of it, you know? And so for me, I just had to say, well, suddenly my nurturing skills need to step up, you know, and I've got to be willing to do whatever it takes, to help my children through this tremendous shock that they're going through. So that was really the beginning of that, was more about that change in life, not as much about the cancer or the possibility of death. It took them a long time to realize that that could be where we were headed.
And Chris, you and Angela were devout Catholics, and you just described your intentionality as a Catholic father. When your wife is stricken with a cancer diagnosis that might take her life, with all the anxiety, with all the hope, with all the trust, that huge stew of different emotions. There are people listening to the show today who have loved ones that are afflicted with difficult, perhaps terminal diseases. What did you learn in that process as you went along that you would pass on to others in terms of how you approach the care for somebody very close to you? It could be a spouse, it could be a mom, or it could be a dad in these very trying times.
Yes, you know, it's very difficult, you know, that you go through these phases where you have all the energy in the world and all the, you know, you can take it on. And then you have those moments that are just overwhelming. And, you know, I recall in particular, you know, those first few days in the hospital and being with Angela and really trying to be positive and trying to keep, you know, her focused and not overwhelmed. And then leaving the hospital room and not even realizing I needed to leave because I needed a moment to myself, and walking through the hallway and then just being stricken with grief and pain and sadness. I mean, in particular, you know, I don't know why the hospital planned it this way, but they had a skywalk that went between the two wings of the hospital that was right over top of the morgue. So I'm on the phone, and I look down, and I see a hearse, and I see a coroner's vehicle, and I see the morgue. And I'm on the phone with somebody, and I'm pretty sure I said it to them, I'm standing above the morgue and I'm wondering if that's the last place Angela will go. I had to allow that grief to happen then, because once I went back in that room, it's not that I had to hide my grief, and we cried together, we did all that, but I had to be strong for her, you know, and I had to be able to you know, do whatever request she needed without losing it, you know. Prayer is very difficult in these moments. I mean, it is, and it's not that I stopped believing or had lack of faith, it's just hard to pray. Many of us have had the experience of going to adoration or just going to prayer, and our mind, you know, we start the Hail Mary, and the next thing you know, we're doing our taxes in our head, or we're balancing our checkbook or whatever, and you go, wait, I don't even know where I'm at anymore, you know? Prayer is very difficult. So the sacraments were really important. I remember the day after, 2 days later when Angela went in for surgery, I went to Mass. I actually got to Mass late because I had to walk her into surgery and all of that. But I just remember, you know, during the Eucharistic prayers and during the, you know, after communion, just feeling so much strength, because as you go through the liturgy, you're not focused on you. You know, you realize halfway through, wait a minute, I'm completely focused on God right now. And I realized that I needed that. So I had to really rely on the church. And, you know, I'm one of those people that does spontaneous prayer pretty naturally. But I relied on the Hail Mary and the Rosary and the Divine Mercy Chaplet and the Mass and the Breviary and all of that a lot more since this, because those prayers really helped carry me through. And that's what gave me the strength to care for her. And I would notice when I was overwhelmed and all of that, I needed to go back to the treasures that we have and let God and let the wisdom of the church carry me through that.
Michael.
Chris, you know, in the last year, I was at a presentation by Matthew Kelly, and he said that the United States is suffering from a crisis of fidelity and or faithfulness. And one of the things that from the very beginning of learning about your story, Angela, and your story, and reading this book that jumps, that just screamed at me, was the idea of fidelity, that this is the very, very foundational, not only in a relationship with our spouses in marriage, but also our relationship with God. And you have this great quote, and I'm sure we'll do a few more quotes during this, and I really cannot recommend enough for people to read this book. It's an important book to read, but you have this great quote on page 18. I share this burden because I believe God calls us to be good stewards of all we are given. If we are given a heap of money or a heap of manure, the response God expects from us is the same, faithfulness. Can you speak a little more to that? And I know it's all throughout this book, but it's profound.
Yeah, you know, that was something, you know, this idea of being given a burden versus a blessing. You know, the Friday before Angela's diagnosis was Good Friday, and I had gone to a talk by actually a Protestant pastor who I wanted to, you know, I just went with a friend to this event, and I felt like it was a good way to kind of share Good Friday with a Protestant friend of mine. And this pastor began speaking about the idea that we make vows in life. We like to make promises and vows and say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And what he basically, you know, shared was that God wants us to trust in his vow, not our own, and that he wants to trust in him, not our own. And it really convicted me personally, because in the months leading up to this, I had said things to Angela like, I'm never going to let us fall into poverty again. I'm never going to let us have this. I'm never going to do. And I had made all these promises. And I noticed in those weeks before that I was feeling very anxious about everything. And I went home to Angela after that talk, and I said, you know, I need to go to confession, but I need to confess to you that I'm not going to keep making these, because I promised you I'd lead you to God, and I promised you that I'd be a good steward of what God gave us, and that's what I'm going to promise. And I'm going to let God give us the blessing. And we had this great conversation, you know. And so I felt in that moment like I'm going to be a good steward of the blessings God gives us. And that Sunday, what God handed us was a burden. What God allowed for us was a major burden, a tragic burden in our lives. And what really he showed me over those next few weeks was that may be the blessing, that burden might become the greatest blessing. And I think in order for that to happen, it sounds so oxymoronic, you know, that a burden would become a blessing. In order for a burden to become a blessing, we have to be good stewards. And what that means is we have to take it for what it is. We don't deny that it's painful. We don't deny the suffering itself. We can't complain or lament to God sometimes. But in doing that, we always give it back to him, we always turn it back to him, and we always need to ask him how to use this for good, because he promises us that. And particularly, you know, God convicted me of over and over again during our story. Are you going to be a good steward of this? I'm not giving you a pile of money right now, you know. I'm giving you a hardship, and it's still here, and it's not going away. Are you going to continue being a good steward? Are you going to continue giving this back? And it was really a follower, a supporter of ours who one day said, I want to thank you for your generosity and your stewardship of this story. And it finally clicked for me. I need to be a good steward even of this. You know, I need, because by doing that and by sharing in the way that we felt called to share, we were being generous of heart. We couldn't be generous with money. We had nothing. But by being generous of heart, God used that and allowed us to find blessing in it.
Our guest is Chris Faddis, the author of It Is Well, Life in the Storm. After these messages, we'll hear about how when you're given a burden, a difficult situation, how with God's grace, it can bring you closer to each other and closer to God through trusting him more. We'll discuss that next. Please stay tuned for more of The Good Catholic Life.
Protector, provider, family man. These are the marks of a good father. Yet men today face many challenges living out their role. The weak economy has hit men especially hard, and many others search for a balance between the demands of work and family life. Where could a man look to find answers and encouragement in these challenging times to live a life of virtue and faith? Fathers for Good, a website for men and their families by the Knights of Columbus, gives you the tools you need with timely articles, cutting-edge analysis, videos, and expert advice. Fathers for Good helps you become the dad God calls you to be. In the heart of every man is the desire to be a good father, to do his best for his wife and children. Whether you are a seasoned dad, a new dad, or a dad-to-be, that father can be you. Visit fathersforgood.org and embrace the adventure of fatherhood.
Welcome back to The Good Catholic Life. Thanks so much for joining us today for the incredible story told by Chris Faddis here on our show and in his book, It Is Well, Life in the Storm. The book is an account of his wife Angela's cancer diagnosis, their battle against colon cancer, and then her eventual death on September the 21st, 2012, after about 17, 18 months of struggle against cancer. And Chris, you title the book, It Is Well, and there's a reason for that. Please share that with our listeners.
Sure. You shared before how, you know, Angela and I had talked about a book on trust. It was something I had felt called to write for many years. And during that time, as I was actually working on a manuscript for a book on trust, I had heard the song, and some Catholics are familiar with it, some aren't, but there's a song, a Protestant hymn called It Is Well With My Soul. And I had heard it a few times, and it was something about some of the words just really struck me, and I wanted to know the story. I think often we think of the hymns as coming from an organ loft somewhere, you know, or a monastery somewhere where somebody is just sitting in, you know, in great peace and tranquility and writing these words. And I just knew something about those words, there was something more in the story. So I looked it up, and the story is a Chicago businessman in the late 1800s named Horatio Spafford, who had lost all of his real estate holdings in the Great Chicago Fire, had lost a lot, you know, a lot of different things over the course of a few years, and lost a child. It was really kind of on his way back up. He was building his wealth back up, and he was, you know, doing a little better. And his wife and four daughters and his newborn son were on their way to Europe for a vacation, and he was going to meet them later. And while they were on the boat going across the Atlantic, their boat collided with another ship and capsized, and he lost all four of his daughters. His wife and son were only ones that saved. As he was heading over to Europe to meet his wife and collect his wife and son, he penned these words, the words of this hymn, which, you know, the line that sticks out most to me, that whatever my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well, it is well, it is well with my soul. He says, you know, when, yeah, I can't remember the word. Anyway, but that concept that no matter what, whether there's sorrow, whether there's pain, whether there's joy or goodness, no matter what, it is well with my soul. And the more I reflected on that, the more, as I was sitting down to write a book at one point, I said, you know, Angela, that's where that conversation came up, that I'm not sure if I should write this book now. Maybe someone needs to write a book on trust while they're in the storm, like Horatio was, while they're passing over. Literally, if he's passing over the spot where his daughters died, he writes these words, that whatever my lot, it is well with my soul. And so that really became the theme of what I had felt at some point I would write on trust. I had no clue that the book would be a memoir. I always thought it would be more of a lesson, you know, more of a teaching on trust. And yet what God brought to us was our own storm. And as we were going through that, we saw some similarities to Horatio's story, just as we were passing through, just as Angela was sitting there and the storm came in a big way and she hears about this cancer. She says the words, Jesus still rose. Just as we're finding out that the tumors are growing and not shrinking, Angela would always say, no matter what, I still have to trust in Jesus. That's the only thing I can think is, Jesus, I trust in you. And that really just continued to resonate. And that story really became a big piece of inspiration for us, because as our storm continued, we continually were asked that question, will you trust me whatever your lot? Will you trust me no matter what I give you?
Will you trust if this happens or that, and then something else happens, and then something else happens, and it mm-hmm. just keeps getting harder and harder and harder. And for some of us in life, that's going to be the way that God prepares us for heaven. One of the moving parts of many moving parts of the book, but that caused me to reflect. It's so easy to think if you're blessed with 90 years, let's just pick a number, and at the end of your life, you've had a full life, you've lived a long life, if God's blessed you with children and then grandchildren, then perhaps great-grandchildren, it's easy for me to say, at that point in my life, I'll be longing for heaven, and I hope that happens for me. But when you're 32, like Angela was, and you're formed to know that our destiny on this earth is through God's grace to be united with him in heaven. And there's a longing for heaven, but there's also a fight in us that we want to fight to stay here in this life. And it's not because we love heaven any less. It's just we're wired in a way to want to be there. You and Angela had deep conversations about that, and you write about it movingly in the book. How did you, as faithful Catholics, come to be happy to accept what God gave you, whether it was more days in this life or in one more day or seven more days in terms of a week, or if it was Angela's time to be called home to heaven?
You know, that was definitely a process. I mean, we certainly talked about it from day one. I mean, like I said, I really wasn't sure, given the severity of her diagnosis, that Angela would make it out of the hospital or that she would live more than a couple of months. I had known a few people to be diagnosed with a late stage four cancer that was very aggressive, that had only lived 2 months after that. And so in my mind, I thought we might have a couple months. So at one point, you know, on the one hand, we talked about it very heavily in the beginning. We're, you know, what if you die tomorrow? What if you don't make it out of here? And that. But once we got through that, and the doctors reassured us that we had a little bit of time, and we could at least slow this thing down with treatment, we didn't talk about it as much. And we would come to these grief points where it would come up, and Angela would say things like, "I'm not ready yet. I want to see my kids grow up. I want to see these things. Why, you know, is God going to heal me? I just know God has to heal me because I all these things are important." And then a few days later, she would say something like, "You know, I really don't feel like I'm ready to go to heaven because I don't feel like I'm holy enough. But if God really wants that for me, then I guess that's okay because that's what I've always wanted." And that would, those conversations would vacillate back and forth. But, you know, you kind of just get to a point where you just live each day and you just say, you know, we how grateful you are we woke up today. You know, how grateful Angela was that she was awake that day, and that especially if it was a day where she had energy to play with the kids or to do a fun craft with them, or if she had energy to go for a walk. I mean, I would literally just say, okay, I got to take today off because she's got enough energy. We can go to the park today, you know, and enjoy those little bit of time. And in living that way, you know, you focus less on the 5-year plan. You focus less on when your kid gets to college, when they go to prom, when they get married. You focus more on how am I going to make today an intentional day with my family, an intentional day of love and caring for each other. So that was a big part of how we got through that. But as we got closer to Angela's death, and as, you know, we would find out a little bit more, and a doctor would say, you know, some doctors were promising that surgery was an option. And at one point, which you read about in the book, that, you know, finally a doctor was very honest with us, and he went through every surgery that had been mentioned and that we had read about and that was possible, that we thought could be possible. And he said, this one would kill you because of this, and this one would do this. And he just very lovingly but honestly said to us, you've got to just understand that there's nothing medically we can do to kill this cancer. And we had been to alternative therapies. We've been to everything. You know, people always say, yeah, but if you did this, and we've been through all of that. He said, and he just really helped us face that. So that helped us to really face the grief a little bit more realistically and say, okay, unless God saves you, you're going to die. So we have to be realistic, and we have to prepare our hearts for that death. That was not easy, but it certainly was important that we did that. So Angela began to read books on grief. She, in particular, she read A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis, which is probably the classic, you know, probably one of the classics when it comes to a book on grief, and it's just Lewis sharing his grief after losing his wife. And Lewis's words for her spoke her heart. They were the words that she finally was able to put words to her grief. And by her being able to share that with me, I could then be honest about my grief. And so that you know, really just comes with being honest. You have to be realistic and say, we're facing this. The reality is that this is going to happen, which in a completely, you know, without looking at it from a miracle sense, the reality is that Angela will die soon. We also believe in a different reality, so we certainly had hope in a miracle. But we had to face that honestly, and by doing that, we were able to slowly begin to accept that reality.
One of the things that you concluded after, I think it was after Angela's death, but it might have been as she was going through the process of fighting cancer, is that God loves us all so much, and what he gives us in life is meant to prepare us in a unique way because of our own unique situation for heaven. And you wrote in the book that you believe Angela's cancer was part of God's plan to purify her. I mean, that can sound to somebody, you know, it can sound moving, it can sound simple, it can sound like an after-the-fact rationalization to people, but as a person of faith, you know this to be true. How did that help you walk with Angela through this journey, knowing that it wasn't just you holding her hand, but that eventually you were going to give her hand to Christ, and he would help lead her through the narrow gate into heaven?
Yeah, you know, that statement came from Angela about a week after her diagnosis originally. She said, you know, it was actually after a night where I was fighting with God. I was pretty much lamenting and yelling at heaven, saying, why are you putting us through this? And I had just really been overwhelmed that day. And the next day he answered me, and the answer came in Angela saying to me, you know, I really think that God's going to use this cancer to purify me. He's going to make me holy with this cancer. And he's gonna purify my heart. He's gonna you know, cleanse me through this. And I hope that means that I'll be able to live a holy life on this earth, but it might not. I just know that's what's gonna happen. And so that was always in the back of my mind as we would go through these moments of wondering how much time she had left. As we got to the very end, as we got to the, you know, July of 2012, as her condition began to really worsen, she was in the hospital and things were really looking bad, and then she got home and started to have even more situation. I had to go back to the hospital, and that was her last stay for, you know, most of August in the hospital. And during that time, you know, Angela was really facing this grief of, I'm not ready yet. She would start saying that again, I'm not ready yet. I'm just not holy enough. And I would just say, Angela, if God wants you to go home, he will make you holy. And so she began to just, as she would go through those moments and feel like she wasn't ready, just turn that back to God and say, Lord, if you're taking me, please make me ready. And what I witnessed then was what she said. She said, she had said, you know, over a year before that, I think God's going to purify me. And over those last 8 weeks, God truly began to purify her. As she slowly surrendered the kids and I, as she slowly surrendered her hopes and dreams, as she slowly surrendered, you know, the possibility of a medical cure, she slowly surrendered all of that to God, she would turn it back to him and say, you know what, I'm not in control. He obviously has a different plan. And you began to see her kind of strip herself of all earthly desire. And at one point I said to somebody, I said, you know, it's like I would tell her something about the kids, and she cared, she loved them, but it was a separation. It was like she had already detached from us and was focused on heaven. And what I watched was this purity come out of her and this pure intention for heaven. And that was, it was in a sense, it was a hindsight, like you said, but at the same time, it was something where I got to see what God had already told her. I will purify you through this. Be faithful. And I got to then, as her husband, watch that purification happen. In those last 8 weeks, it was amazing to watch what God did through her, God did in her, as she would offer her suffering for the people around the country that were praying for her. And I think, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this as we began to then get letters and cards and emails from people saying, I just want you to know that by me praying for Angela, I have been healed of XYZ going on in my life. And I went, whoa, wait a minute. This is what God means by redemptive suffering. This is what he means by giving it back to him.
And you were asking everybody who was already connected with you as friends, but those that started to follow your story through social media and other forms, to pray for Angela and for your family, but then you started receiving prayer requests from them so that you turned your focus and Angela turned her focus outward in the moments that she had to pray for other people. I don't know if I was in that situation that that's what I would start to think about. And it moved me to say, you know what? There are times where I feel like I'm in a rut or I'm in a worse place than I might have been a week or a month ago. But one of the good things is, you know, there are other people that are in tough situations now. And one of the ways that I can focus on doing some good in whatever energy and whatever time that I have is to storm heaven with prayers to somebody else. And you did that. And that mattered a lot. And you got confirmation that your prayers were being listened to and that people who you were praying for were getting healing from God, not necessarily exactly what they were asking for. We know with prayer, God doesn't necessarily always give us what we think we want, but he gives us out of love what we need in that situation. And that's what happened in your case.
Yeah, it was really remarkable to have to start to get letters, you know, and you know, we had people that were asking us for prayers throughout. I had a few times said, you know, we'd like to pray for people because we just felt this debt of gratitude to these people from around the country, who many of which we didn't know, who were praying for us. But as that grew in those last couple months and that firestorm of prayer from around the country and really around the world began to go, at one point, you know, when Angela was in, she was home in hospice at this point, and her physician had come to see her and prepare her. And she said, you know, she had noticed signs, and, you know, physicians can kind of predict where someone's at in their dying process. And so she was able to see that she felt she had 3 to 5 days left. And she said, Angela, she prepared her, and she said, I want you to know that what's going to happen and how you're going to go, and I want you to have peace about it and not worry, because what's going to happen is you're essentially just going to fall asleep. And next thing you know, you're going to wake up, and the vastness of what's on the other side is going to take you home, and the love that is greater than ours is going to swallow you whole and embrace you. And she said, Angela said back to her, she said, I have a lot of people to pray for when I get to heaven. And that really hit me, and I went, wait a minute, she's thinking of all those people who've been praying for her. So I asked her later, and she said, yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. And so I would begin to take those prayer requests we were getting specifically to her bed. And I didn't necessarily read them all to her. I a lot of times had them in my heart, and I would say, we need to pray for all these people. And Angela would very intentionally just pray. And I didn't say a whole lot, but I knew she was offering that back. What was amazing is in those coming weeks following was then to start getting emails saying, I just want you to know that my sister had been praying for Angela, and now she's going back to church. I want you to know that I've been dealing with infertility, and I finally, you know, offered that suffering for Angela, and guess what? I'm pregnant. I want you to know, you know, I mean, amazing things. And I mean, for me as a husband, to lose my wife, there's some solace there in knowing that perhaps, you know, there's purpose to this, that perhaps if one soul got back to God that had been away from the church for 30 years, if that soul was saved because they prayed and they were brought back to God in that way, doesn't that make it worth it? If we really believe what we believe, doesn't it make it worth it? And I think that was also around the time that I found the quote that, you know, of St. Faustina, where Jesus tells her in her diary that she's no longer suffering for herself but for souls. And essentially that through her long suffering, many would be brought back to faith. And that, I realized, was what my wife was experiencing in that moment, in that time.
Michael.
Chris, you know, selfless love, intercessory prayer, trust, stewardship, redemptive suffering, holiness, purification, fidelity, sacraments. I could go on and on and on. All these themes that come through in this book. It's a virtual catechesis, quite frankly, and a real life experience of living out our Catholic faith. And not only that, it seemed that there was an awareness on Angela's part that she was being used, and you've already shared some experiences of this, to be a witness, to give testimony to faith in Jesus Christ. And I love the fact that you referenced that she posted on her Facebook page in April of 2012, quoting Benedict XVI, I have a mustard seed and I'm not afraid to use it. Mm. You had an interesting take on that quote.
Yeah, you know, I realized that when she posted that, I thought, wow, like that explains a lot, you know, and especially after, I mean, this was more reflecting after she died, that that it really was that mustard seed that had been implanted in her years before. And she would always talk about it. She would share with teens when we were in youth ministry, and she would share with other people, you know, that if you pray now, well, things are good. If you pray while you're young, or you pray while your faith is hot and everything's going well, you can really build up your faith to a point where when you do face this storm, it can carry you through. And that was a big part for her, was she felt like by her having that faith at such a young age and really, you know, developing that faith, it helped her, because there were days where she would say, I just can't pray. But I'm so grateful, one, that I prayed up before, and two, that I had so many people praying for me right now, because I feel that those prayers are going to carry me through. And she would simply say to God, Lord, I just give you all the prayers that I've stored up for you, you know. And that mustard seed really did well up within her. And that the song, again, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say. And it's written on our hearts. I mean, it's that whole idea that the faith is written on our hearts. If we allow God in, if we allow faith in at some point in our lives, it can well up within us at this time, especially if we've continued to practice it. And for Angela, you know, I don't know that she always knew how to use her mustard seed. There were many times when she felt like, I don't know what to do. But she would just simply say to God, I don't feel faith right now. I don't even comprehend it right now. But I know in my heart who you are. I know in my mind what I believe. And so I'm just going to give that to you and ask you to carry me through. And I think, ultimately, if you were to take that Benedict quote, you know, I have a mustard seed and I'm not afraid to use it. I think sometimes we could say, I have a mustard seed and I'm not quite sure how to use it. Mm-hmm. And if we just say to God, Lord, can you use my mustard seed? Can you help me? Can you show me how to use this? He will be faithful. That's what I learned from Angela. He will be faithful, and he will bring us through that.
We're speaking with Chris Faddis, the remarkable story that he recounts in the book, It Is Well, Life in the Storm. You can find more about this book and Chris's professional speaking at itiswellbook.com. Chris, as I was reading the final chapters of the book, it was obvious to me, as a person of faith, that God was going to take Angela when the time was absolutely right for her. And there were two timing episodes that I think were that particularly helped me draw that conclusion. One was, you thought Angela was going to go home to God a few weeks prior to when she went. But in those intervening weeks, Angela was able to give the gift of forgiveness to somebody that had hurt her deeply in life. And how much that meant to the person who was receiving that forgiveness, perhaps more than it meant to Angela or to you at that time. And then at the final moment of Angela's death, God waited until your daughter was able to kiss her on the forehead, and then he took her right then. And that, to me, showed, look, you and Angela, through this very difficult situation, trusted in God to the best of your abilities, tried to grow in trust, tried to grow in faithfulness, and God reciprocated in two very moving ways, and particularly that he took Angela, you know, split seconds after your daughter's lips left her forehead. What a loving God we have. Please talk about divine timing in Angela's final weeks and moments in this life.
Yeah, you know, so that was, you know, the doctor had come, and I shared with you what Angela said about wanting to pray for people. She also said after that, she said, you know, I had come to see her after the doctor left. I said, are you okay? She thought she would be grieving again. And she said, I'm at peace. I want the world to know that no matter what, they must trust in Jesus. And that, for me, was an acceptance of saying, okay, if you're accepting that and you're saying, look, I just am going to let this go because I think God is doing something here. And that's clearly what it was to me, that she just realized that God had a greater story here than her living. And so a few nights later, she actually crashed. I mean, she was dying. At one point, she literally, all the breath was gone. But she had basically had what's called terminal restlessness. And the way she went was very kind of violent in a sense, and almost like she was fighting back and her body was trying to come back. And I had promised her she would go in peace. And so as a husband, I just felt like this wasn't the right time. So I gave her one or two chest compressions and she started to breathe again. And then she slowly recovered, and the doctor thought she would go within the next few hours. But I felt like at least she would go in peace. Well, she didn't go. She lived, and she actually rebounded. And it was almost as if she rebounded for a reason, and I wasn't sure. About a week later, a family member came in, or maybe it was that week, who, as I shared, had hurt Angela very greatly and hurt our family, and the hurt had continued. And so Angela, at one point in our lives, had to finally ask this person to stay out of our lives, and we had to do that, which was a painful thing. It wasn't something she wanted. She confessed it over and over again, and she spoke to priests and counselors, and Angela tried to reconcile, and it just wasn't good for her, for our family, and we felt like that boundary needed to be there. Angela had forgiven her. Angela had sent her a letter saying she forgave her, but she still came into town, and it was really through a friend challenging me and saying, I know you're trying to protect your wife because she said she didn't need to see her. I know you're trying to do all these things and you're honoring your vocation. But he said, I think we need to think about what God might have in store here. And so we prayed about it. And he really challenged me in a way that I needed to be challenged and took it to prayer. And I said, okay, I guess that there's a mercy here that I don't have and God wants to extend. So she came, and it was absolutely incredible as Angela offered forgiveness face-to-face. And Angela loved her, even though there were still some things being said that, you know, were not great. But Angela just loved her through it, and Angela just you know, gave her the mercy she needed. And it was absolutely a powerful scene. And I was in tears. And this is somebody who's hurt me personally greatly, and I was still struggling with forgiveness myself. But in that moment, I was able to forgive because of Angela's mercy. You know, we still don't have contact with this family member. I have not seen her since the funeral, and most likely won't. But I know that the mercy was given, and I know God will work in that. So I thought, after that moment, I truly thought Angela would probably go within the next few days. And she didn't. She lived longer. I think one thing, you know, you said those two things. I also think, Scott, that God kept her there for this suffering for others, because Angela truly was offering. And I really think that those last few weeks were for those of us around her, but also all those people praying for her, that God had more lessons to teach us all. God had more miracles to do among us. And I think that was a part of it, was that she was left to suffer for us. And then, that she stayed for my daughter to kiss her. If you knew the connection that Angela and Gianna had. And you know, my daughter Gianna, obviously named after St. Gianna, a man who a mutual friend connected us to, you know, who told the story to, was very connected to Gianna Emanuela, the daughter of St. Gianna. And he had asked Gianna Emanuela to pray for Angela and to pray for our Gianna. Gianna Emanuela's prayer, she went to her mother's grave, and her prayer was that her mother would welcome Angela to heaven and that she would embrace Gianna and comfort her from heaven with her prayers. Not that she would find healing, but that she would welcome her to heaven. And so my Gianna had great connection to that story of mother-daughter, you know. So for her to be the last one to kiss her, for her to be the last one to say goodbye, and literally as I raised her to Angela, she kissed her on her head and she took her last breath. There is such a depth there. And then to find out, as you'll see in the book, that she had actually told her confessor that what she saw at the end was that I would be holding her in great suffering. But then suddenly I was no longer holding her and Jesus was holding her. And she was home, and she was no longer in pain. To know that that's essentially what happened, as I held her hand those last 5 hours, I felt at one point like she was gone, but she was waiting. And then I brought my daughter to her, she kissed her, and then she went home. There's such a profound peace for me, for our family, in knowing that God ordained, allowed all of it. God was there in all of it, and it was his perfect timing, just as you said.
And Angela Faddis was taken to heaven through that narrow gate on September 21st, 2012. Chris, I'm sure our listeners want to hear how you and Gianna and Gus have continued to go on in loving memory of Angela, and that you're telling her story not only in the book and on radio programs like this, but speaking across the country. Tell us more about the three of you living now with your wife and their mom in heaven.
Yeah, you know, it's been a year now, so we've made that year mark, which is always a kind of an interesting time. My children have a very tremendously a beautiful sense of understanding that their mother is in heaven, that she's where she's supposed to be, where she wanted to be. and a joy in that. They really, you know, and they know. I mean, Gianna will say over and over again, "Mommy really is going to be a saint," you know. And I'll just say, "Well, she's a saint anyway." You know, even if we don't ever get a capital S by her name, she's a saint. I mean, we know she's in heaven. We've had lots of confirmations of that. And they have a real peace about that. They actually have a sense of joy when we go to the cemetery. They love sitting around her grave and just telling stories. And they smile. They like taking her flowers. That being said, they do grieve. They do have sadness. My daughter right now is going through a period of sadness. And you know, we've had a lot of conversations the last couple of months. But underlying is this understanding that their mom is where she's supposed to be. So, you know, overall, we're doing well. I mean, I think there's definitely a grace for me as a father when you have children who you have to wake up for every day. You know, you don't get to just lay in bed and cry. And that's not in a sense that I'm not allowing grief to happen. It just is. We just have to move on and live. And God has been so faithful in this last year in allowing me to write the book. I mean, that I ever would be able to write these words down, especially in the first year, allowing the book to get out, all of that. So God has been extremely faithful and really brought us through, and it's been an incredible incredibly gifted year.
He is Chris Faddis. The book is It Is Well, Life in the Storm. The website is itiswellbook.com. For our guest, Chris Faddis, and his incredible story, from Michael Levine, our co-host, for our production team of Don Bettinelli, George Martell, and Stacia Morabito, this is Scott Landry saying, thank you for listening. God bless you, and have a wonderful evening.